Good evening, everybody. I want to keep this sort of informal, but I do want to get out a lot of information because I think one of the biggest issues with veterans' issues and problems in today's society starts at home, and it's that such a small percentage of us are veterans anymore in our country. A very small percentage of the American population serves in the military. Are there any veterans in here right now? Women vets, real high. Okay. Thank you for your service. What about dependents or family members of veterans, service members? Okay, more. Thank you for your service. I grew up as an Army brat, so I know that that's hard as well. My father deployed to the first Gulf War. I think first I want to thank Mick and Jan and Tarek and, of course, Steve for pulling this together. Again, this lends to one of the biggest issues that we see, which is awareness by the American public about veterans in service and veterans in communities and military service as well, and especially how women are serving in America's country, America's militaries, and making it stronger and greater, and our contributions to that effect and to that effort. One of the most important things I want you all to consider first is all of us probably know a police officer, correct? Yeah. We all know police officers. Police officers are men and women. They serve on the forces. They run patrols on a daily basis. They have their beats. They answer calls. When the operator answers the phone and the dispatcher dispatches the squad car, they don't ask specifically a male or a female officer. When military police are in Iraq or Afghanistan, they aren't differentiated by their sex. They do their job, and their job is to patrol neighborhoods, to talk to locals, to ride the same routes every day. They call those route clearance patrols. When a Humvee, which is the military vehicle, has people inside of it, when they have service members inside of it, everybody takes a turn on the gun, on the main gun, as a crew serve weapon, usually a 50 cal or some other type of automatic machine gun that is sort of a first resort in an attack. So when in a vehicle or convoy is ambushed in the street in Iraq or in Afghanistan, or a car drives too close to the vehicle and gets like right in the middle of a convoy and looks like it's going to attack a convoy, that person in the turret engages. And that person in the turret can be a woman or a man. It doesn't really matter. The other issues, medical community. We look at a lot of people in the medical community, a lot of nurses, a lot of EMTs, a lot of paramedics, and even firefighters. A lot of them are emergency first responders. They are men and women. And again, there isn't a differentiation in a phone call to the emergency medical system or service for a male or a female. And the same is true in the military. Combat medics in the military can be male or female. They are called combat medics because it's their job to be attached to units, doesn't matter what type of unit, and to go out among wherever these units go and be the medical emergency personnel for that team or that unit. They don't, again, necessarily differentiate between male or female. A lot of times the infantry units that are all male will prefer to have a man, but with the needs and the short personnel shortages that are out there now and that occur, you don't always get that choice. So a lot of times these medics that are going out there, these combat medics, are women as well. Also in the intelligence, some of you, has anyone seen the movie Lioness, the documentary? Okay. In intelligence community, your job essentially, and one of the disciplines within the intel community, your job essentially is to go out and talk to the locals. It's called atmospherics, find out what they're doing, what they're thinking, how we can help them. Civil affairs people do the same thing. They go out to the communities, they talk to people, they talk to locals. They find out from the local chiefs and the local elders in the communities and the local leaders, what types of things they need in infrastructure. Do they need a well? Do they need bridges? Do they need a school? What do they need to help their country get back on their feet? These civil affairs positions and these intel positions are not closed to women, they're open to women. And on a daily basis, their mission is to go outside of the wire, outside of the protection of the walls and the barriers of our compounds, out there wearing the same uniform and the same equipment that the men wear. It's important for you to sort of understand on a really small, on a personal level, what this means. That any one of you could join up to be a quartermaster or supply person in the military. And your job is going to be to take materials and much needed supplies, sometimes mail, to service members that are serving outside the wire all over the country of Afghanistan and Iraq and many other places in the world where we serve. They don't ask you if you're male or female before they select you for a convoy. As a leader, you have a certain number of people that are able to go, and you send who can go. And the reason why I want you to understand this is because of the current Department of Defense policy on women in combat. Currently, the Department of Defense bans women from combat. The actual policy states, service members are eligible to be assigned to all positions for which they are qualified, except that women shall be excluded from assignment to units below the brigade level whose primary mission is to engage in direct combat on the ground. And many would argue, and many in there would be right, that this is actually not happening, that women are not assigned to combat units, which would be infantry or special forces or special operations units or armor, that they are not assigned to these units below the brigade level. Okay? This might be true. However, the way they get around this is they attach women to these units. So I could deploy to Afghanistan and be attached to an infantry unit, not assigned, which basically really is just an admin difference. It's an administrative difference. My paperwork is handled by another unit, but I live and I work with and I serve alongside combat arms MOSs, combat arms military occupational specialties. You'll hear me probably say MOS a lot. It also goes on to define direct combat as engaging an enemy on the ground with individual or crew-served weapons while being exposed to hostile fire and to a high probability of direct physical contact with hostile forces personnel. Direct ground combat takes place well forward of the battlefield while locating and closing with the enemy to defeat them by fire, maneuver, and shock effect. Now, based off of what I told you about our military police, what do you think they do every day on a daily basis? They are actually out there in direct combat, engaging with potentially hostile forces. They are well forward on today's battlefield, which isn't reserved to any geographic line or location. You know, you don't cross a line and all of a sudden you're in combat. The whole place, the whole country, the whole area of operations is all considered combat. Locating and closing with the enemy to defeat them by fire, maneuver, and shock effect. Our intel people do the same thing. All the women who are attached to infantry and combat arms units do the same thing. So the question is whether or not the military and Department of Defense are following their own policy. And one of the biggest fights that we have as an organization and as women veterans and people who serve in the military in today's conflicts and who understand the nature of today's conflicts and counterinsurgency operations is that this policy bars women, one, from the recognition and the acceptance. The second thing it also prevents and impacts is our ability to receive adequate health care and adequate benefits. It also sort of prevents women, from sort of self-identifying as veterans. Most women we talk to who served in the military don't know that they're veterans. They imagine veterans to be people at the American Legion or at the local VFW bar, older gentlemen who sit and have a couple of beers and talk about stories from Vietnam and other areas that they've been in the world in their time and service. What a lot of women don't understand is that they actually are veterans themselves. My background, as many of you know, you may have seen in some print, that I'm a veteran of combat operations in Afghanistan. I was there in 2006. And while serving there, I volunteered while serving in the Army Reserves, I volunteered for a 32-month active duty stint with the 10th Mountain Division up in Fort Drum, New York. We deployed to Afghanistan in 2005. Prior to that, I had done an entire year. I'm sorry, in 2005, I did an entire year of Pashto training. I learned Pashto, which is the language of the Afghans in southern and western, eastern portions of Afghanistan. My job as someone who was learning Pashto was to interact with the locals. April 7th of 06, we actually deployed in February of 06, my convoy was attacked by a suicide vehicle-borne IED. And what that means is a man driving a Corolla packed with explosives drove into my truck and exploded. There were five people in that truck and all of us survived. Miraculously, we all walked away from the explosion. We did so because we were in a vehicle that was much more up-armored than the standard military issue Humvee that we were given. If we had not been in that truck, we wouldn't be where we are today, any of us. So the car disintegrated. In fact, it took them 24 hours to convince me that a car had actually driven into our truck. I had to go and see the remnants of the vehicle. They had an engine block. They had bits and pieces of twisted metal. It all fit on one of those pallets that you ship stuff on. And it was all that was left was like a wheel well and a few other bits and pieces and the engine block. The engine block was 100 meters approximately from the explosion, from the blast site. So if that could tell you anything, if you know how heavy engine blocks are, then you can sort of get an image of what that meant. The pieces that they picked up of the suicide bomber fit in a small, tiny plastic bag. Although the five of us survived, and most of us went on to serve, we stayed on mission. We didn't come back up to the main base to receive treatment. We stayed at our little location because most of the wounds that we had received were sort of superficial burns, cuts, scrapes. I think one of the people in our vehicle got a stitch. We thought we were all okay because we were so pumped up on adrenaline. And we stayed on mission, and we continued our mission, and a couple weeks later, we went back to the main base, and that's when my partner, my buddy, started to experience a lot of really strange things that they attributed to anxiety disorder, that he was having anxiety. So the answer to his anxiety was to send him back outside the wire so he could get back on the horse, where I was left to stay on the main base and was told that I couldn't go back outside and continue on with my job and the training that I had been trained, or the training that I had received. The training that had been given to me to do my job I wasn't able to go and do. Sorry, I'm a little nervous. I get really emotional when I talk about that, and especially since it was 4 years ago this month. Anyway, weeks after returning home from our military service, so we went back to our main base, then we came back to Fort Drum in New York. My buddy immediately went home to Maryland. I stayed at Fort Drum for another 8 months. My boss kept me there. He thought that it would be a good idea to keep me there as long as possible so that I could reintegrate. I went back home to Washington, D.C., where I live, and I was completely alone. I had left my soldiers. I had left my friends. I had left my family, and they were gearing back up to go to Iraq without me. And if any of you have siblings that you take care of, or someone that you take care of, or if you are former military and you've had soldiers, you might understand what it feels like to be a mama hen and to have these people that you take care of and then know that they're going to another combat zone without you, that you're not going to be there to look after them and to take care of them. So it wasn't until that point that I really started to hit what I call my rock bottom. I was alone. I wasn't sleeping. When I did sleep, I would sleep for days. I locked myself in my apartment. I wouldn't talk to anybody. And there was a point where I tell people I fell down a well. And I explain this to a lot of people in different ways. I've never considered myself ever in my entire life somebody who would even entertain the thought of suicide. And I don't know that I actually entertained the thought so much as I just gave up. I felt like I had fallen down this well and I could see the light at the top and I didn't care. I didn't want to try to reach it. I didn't want to do anything about it. I just wanted to stay there and disappear and go to sleep and never wake up. And that's sort of when I knew that things had sort of gotten really out of control and I couldn't control it, I wasn't as tough as I thought I was, I guess. But what saved me was actually writing. I've always been a writer, and I started to journal, and I sort of pulled myself through that by writing my emotions and what I was going through. And after that, I started to look for other veterans who were going through what I was going through, because I knew I couldn't be the only one. And I found a veterans group where I became an advocate, and I decided that I would do whatever I could to help veterans transitioning home. As I worked as an advocate for another organization, I realized that there was still something missing. And I eventually came to understand what that was. And what was missing was other women veterans. Other women veterans who had been through what I had been through and who knew what I felt. You know, I would go out for drinks with the guys, and they would get bought drinks, and people would come up and thank them for their service, and then they would look at me, and one man actually said, bless his heart, he was a very nice older gentleman, he actually said to the guys, you know, thank you for your service, and the guys were like, hey, she was with us, she's one of us. And the gentleman looked at me and he goes, well, my dear, thank you for your service. I thought you were just eye candy. You know, I was there to hang out with the guys. So that's when I started to think, okay, I need to find other women veterans who understand what I'm going through. And I see some of you shaking your heads because you might understand some of this and relate to it. But that's why women veterans. That's why there needed to be another organization for women veterans. Most of the organizations that exist today, the American Legion, the VFW, are phenomenal organizations. There are so many of them out there. The Disabled American Veterans, the American Veterans, AMVETS, the Blind Veterans of America. There's a number of veteran service organizations out there, but there was not one that was actively involved in advocacy and working towards addressing the issues of women veterans specifically and families of veterans. So that's sort of something that we started to see a void for and wanted to start addressing. Some of the issues that affect women veterans and are related to the growing number of women veterans. We're seeing a lot of these issues grow quite a bit. And sort of what we want to do with American Women Veterans is get in front of that and get in front of the issues and address some of the concerns that are happening. But let me give you some background. 1.2 million women veterans are in America today. And it's cute. I see you guys taking notes, so I'm going to go through these statistics kind of slow. But 1.2 million women veterans in America today. That's from all service branches and all eras. Women veterans, of course, like I said before, don't identify as being veterans. So finding those women and getting outreach to them is not always easy. Women also have higher divorce rates than our male counterparts in the military. We are more likely to marry other service members. And the divorce rates in the military are higher than they are among our civilian counterparts. But men in the military tend to marry more often civilians, so they don't have as high of divorce rates as we do. We are also more likely to be caregivers and single mothers, whether we're taking care of a family member or we're taking care of children. We are seeing very, very rapidly growing rates of single mothers in the military. The homeless population in America, of the entire homeless population in America, they estimate about a third of them are veterans, okay? Women are about 15% of that homeless veteran population. Now, the fastest growing demographic of homeless veteran is women with children. Not just women, women with children. This rise in homelessness has been attributed to lack of support, being able to have access to health care, and also in not getting the transition, going through the transition that they need when they get out of the military service. A lot of young women join the military for various reasons, and many of them join for the same reasons men do, to get away from their small towns, to have more opportunity, to see the world, to get money for school. They go in at very young ages. Many of you are here are about the age of my soldiers during our first deployment, 19, 20 years old. They're in the military for 4 to 5 years, and we look after their every need. And then they come out of the military, and they no longer have the support system that they had while they were in. Now, a lot of times, they're more resourceful than a lot of their peers, and a lot more mature, and a lot more worldly. But there are other things they don't necessarily know how to do, like deal with healthcare issues, like do they have access to healthcare? They don't know necessarily how to manage finances, because they've always made a steady paycheck on 2 times a month. There are a lot of little issues like they have know nothing about getting into school. They don't even know what school campuses are like. And that training right now isn't provided to them before they come out of the military. So the other issues that we have are employment issues. Women in the military make equal pay to their peers. Opportunities in some areas are close to them, but they make as much. I make the same as my buddy who's the same rank as I do. When you come out of the military, that's not always the case. Women are less likely to negotiate for the salaries that they deserve. Not only do they not identify as women veterans, they also are not very good at identifying their value in the civilian sector. And this is actually true among women in America as well. Education issues. Currently, the DOD, the Department of Defense, provides and makes mandatory briefings for getting jobs, career counseling, and stuff like that, but not necessarily in getting back into schools. So that's something that we're really pushing and that we really want to see more of, is that before service members exit the military, not just women, but men as well, all of them, get benefits, benefits services and benefits counseling on education and those options, especially with the new GI Bill. And this is where student veterans organizations have really stepped up to take a hold of this issue and to deal with this issue and address this issue on school campuses and university campuses. Healthcare issues. One of the issues that relates to changing the verbiage of the policy on women in combat to reflect what's already happening. These women who are already serving, they need to be able to get this recognition. And it's not just because of recognition. It's not just because we want to identify as having served in combat and being recognized for our contribution. It also has a lot to do with healthcare. A lot of times we hear about these women and we see examples of this where women go to the VA, which is the Veterans Health Administration, the Veterans Administration for care to their hospitals, where they receive free healthcare, and they are not able to prove that they were in combat, because the policy right now states that they're not in combat. So they're going to receive care and services, and they're saying to their counselors, I need to seek treatment because I think I have PTSD. I can't sleep, I can't eat, I can't talk to people, all my relationships have gone down the toilet, my husband left me, my best friend won't talk to me, my family, I don't want to talk to my family. You know, there are all these issues that come from it, and when they finally get the nerve, when they finally get identified and they finally know they're a veteran and they're entitled to services and they overcome all of these barriers, they get to the VA, they sit down with their counselor, and their counselor says to them, you are not in combat. And then it becomes a burden of proof on the veteran to prove that they were actually there. You're not actually discharged out of the military with anything saying that you were actually in combat. So what everybody's been doing lately is raising awareness. We're raising awareness about women in combat. We're making movies. We're putting TV commercials. We're talking to people. We're testifying on the Hill. But nobody's changing the policy, which needs to be altered. It needs to be changed, again, to reflect what's already occurring. So what happens is the woman has to then prove that she was in combat by getting testimonials or sworn statements from people who were there with her. If I did not have a Purple Heart or a Combat Action Badge, which were awards that were given to me because of my injuries and because of the explosion that we went through, if I hadn't been given those, if somebody in my chain of command had not done the paperwork to ensure that I got those awards or recognition, they're not even really awards, actually, but to get those badges, then I would have to prove that I was actually in a vehicle bombing. And the only way to prove that, in my case and in a lot of cases, is through classified material. So this is a burden. This is a sort of a hurdle that women are actually dealing with. So we had one woman who went to a PTSD group, and she was told that she was not allowed there because only men were allowed to go to the PTSD group. So she contacted the local American Legion, the VFW, her senator, congressman, and said, I should be able to go to this group. It's a PTSD group. There's nothing saying women aren't allowed. So they changed the old Vietnam vet who ran that particular group out of his own free time. He changed the requirements of the group to reflect that only combat military occupational specialties could go to that group. So only people who had been infantry or only people who had been special forces or other military occupational specialties that only allow women, I mean men, I'm sorry, only allow men were allowed to go to this group, so she was not able to go. The VA hospital where she was at ended up offering group sessions open to everybody and making it more official. So that did get resolved, but we shouldn't have to have those stories told. We shouldn't have to be hearing that today in today's modern era. So a lot of the things that we're calling for in terms of dealing with women's issues in the VA and the health benefits and the health issues are sort of more women providers. The reason why we need that is because, unlike our male peers, we have a significantly higher rate of military sexual trauma. There are statistics out there that say 1 in 3 women have been sexually assaulted or sexually harassed in the military. That statistic is just, it's so hard to prove, it's so hard to validate. But I would say that there are quite a number of women who are sexually harassed in the military. I think it works both ways sometimes, but it definitely happens. It's a lot like high school and junior high, when you come back to school and things start changing and you have people that live together and work together on a daily basis and who are going to school together every day. And, you know, sexual harassment is unwanted attention from someone. And if somebody doesn't get the message, that can, and he persists or she persists, that can actually be considered sexual harassment. But military sexual trauma is something that women, a majority of women, deal with more than men do. The rates are much higher, but it does happen to men as well. There is a story of a woman who was pulling guard one night, because we have to pull guard just like everybody else. And she had decided to take a smoke break, because really in the military sometimes, unfortunately, smoking is the only time you get a break. So she decided to take a smoke break. She left her weapon where her, what we call battle buddy, her partner, could watch it, and she went to go smoke to the smoking section. As she was walking back, she was attacked and raped. And she was on guard duty. She had left her weapon. She had just gone over to get a smoke real quick. She knew the man who did it. But she was told that if she reported her rape, that she would be punished for having left her weapon, because she was on guard duty. And so she never reported it. The statistics for military sexual trauma, and specifically rape in the military, is pretty high. In the military, if you are sexually assaulted, the prosecution rate that result in courts martial is about 8% of reported sexual assaults. Now, that's reported sexual assaults. That does not account for the number of sexual assaults that are not reported. In the civilian world, prosecution rate is about 40%. So a man in the military is more likely to get away, or a woman in the military is more likely to get away with sexual assault and rape than in the civilian world. This means a lot of different things. It means that a lot of people are getting away with it, that are probably becoming repeat offenders. And a lot of times, if a man is convicted or a woman is convicted of rape or sexual assault, they are usually demoted, their rank is taken away from them, they are docked pay, and they may be kicked out of the military with a dishonorable discharge. Unfortunately, that is nothing compared to a rape conviction in the civilian world. Okay. Thousands of unregistered sex offenders are honorably discharged from the military every year and released into the civilian world. This also affects the victim's state of mind, because she realizes that that person got away with it. She may feel guilty about what happened, but she may also carry guilt for not reporting it. But then they also know that the statistics for women who get out of the military after reporting a sexual assault are significantly high as well. So there are a lot of issues that we deal with in terms of not just combat stress, not just worrying about healthcare, not just worrying about our children or our families. There are so many. And then on top of this, we have women who are dealing with military sexual trauma and the results and the residual effect of that after they get out of service, who don't self-identify and aren't getting treatment from local communities, organizations. Reaching out to other veterans groups helps a lot too, because veterans know how to take care of each other. But it's really vital that our country get aware of these issues and sort of address some of these and ask the right questions and demand to hear about these issues, and then also get involved. You don't have to be a student veteran to be in the student veterans organization. You may know something about harassment or military sexual trauma, or you may know something about harassment or trauma, sexual trauma. You may know something about what it means to leave your family, or what it means to be even a single parent. All of those things can help. And maybe you're just somebody that really cares. Most of our volunteers at American Women Veterans are people who are not veterans themselves, who want to give service to veterans because they didn't really feel that the military was their calling. But women veterans of all generations are entitled to VA services and health care. They need PTSD and support groups. They need availability of child care to come to classes, to go to hospital appointments. A lot of the VA healthcare centers are located quite a distance away from where veterans actually live. A lot of veterans come from rural communities, and we know Nebraska has quite a few rural communities that veterans go, they leave, they come home, they go back to their communities, and they may not be able to network or talk with other veterans to receive care. And then, for example, in San Antonio, Texas, a group of friends of mine who are veterans walk every year 500 and something miles to San Antonio, Texas, in order to receive treatment from the VA. They walk because the point they're trying to make is we can't take entire days off of work and pay babysitters for entire days to drive all the way up to San Antonio to go to one appointment just to have you tell me that I have to go bring you proof that I served in combat or for whatever reason, multiple appointments. So there are a lot of ways that you can get involved. There's veterans, nonprofit groups out there that babysit, that volunteer their time in babysitting. There are nonprofit groups that volunteer their time in everything from dog training to reading books to military children whose parents are deployed, everything you can think of. So some of the solutions are what we're doing here, becoming aware, understanding the issues, asking the questions, contacting your local politicians, just at the community level. It doesn't even have to be at the national level. But you can also contact organizations such as ours and the VFW and the American Legion, who are always great for resources, for support. If you know somebody who's going through something or you think there might be some issues, there's always someone you can call or reach out to. Raise awareness, spread the word. Lioness is a great documentary to watch. It's a documentary about women who were pulled from their jobs as supply NCOs and admin, and they were put in the heat of battle in the middle of Iraq as gunfire was going on around them, rockets. I mean, these women, you see their stories, and you will definitely understand why there are some of the issues that there are with in terms of service and how we are when we come home. Veterans getting the care they need when they need it, the DOD and VA efforts to ensure that this happens, the DOD and VA need to work closer together and sort of just pay attention to what's going on and what the DOD is doing and how the DOD is the Department of Defense. When you're on active duty in your National Guard or Reserves, you belong to the DOD. And then when you're out of the military and you become a veteran, you now sort of belong under the VA umbrella. And the difference is those two organizations don't always work together or talk to each other. So, for example, if you were a veteran that received injuries or issues while on active duty and your medical records have that information, you go into the Veterans Administration, and if you don't have a copy of your medical records, then you're going to have to find a way to get it to prove that you were through that. So I could talk for hours, and I don't want to anymore, and I feel really bad because this was actually supposed to be very, informal and, a talk back and forth. But I wanted to sort of get a lot of the information out there for those of you who are taking notes or maybe receiving credit for the briefing. Do you have any questions? And is there anything that you want to tell me that I can take back to Washington, D.C. and to Capitol Hill when I'm talking to state legislatures? Personal experiences or anecdotes, anything at all?
Well, first of all, Leif, I'd like to say thank you very much for your service, and we certainly appreciate you coming to speak to us today. Again, I'd like to encourage everyone to come to the mic to ask some questions because, again, we are audio recording this. But let me just begin with my own question here, and I'm wondering, can you talk a little bit more? You mentioned that the fastest growing population of homeless is women veterans with children?
Yes.
Was that correct?
The fastest growing demographic of homeless veterans is women with children.
Can you talk a little bit about the causes and what is being done about this? Thanks.
Well, here's the sort of the disconnect that we see, and we're a very new organization, so we're still working on addressing some of these issues. So it's sort of a two-part question, the causes and what's being done about it. The causes tend to be all of the residual effects from combat and from service. It can be military sexual trauma that is not dealt with, that care is not received for, you know, she's not seeking treatment or she's not talking to someone. And then what ends up happening is depression sets in. And once depression sets in, this it can result in and sort of manifest in a lot of different ways, which then can resort to homelessness and suicide. Homelessness, we see a direct indicator being the fact that they're just not coping or adjusting well when they get home and they get out of military service. They're not receiving the support system that they're used to having within the military, where we take care of each other and take care of our own, and you always have somebody to go to. And you know who that person is that you need to go to talk to. So there are a number of issues, but health, addressing the health problems is probably the biggest issue, especially in terms of mental health. Mental health is a very nasty and horrible and very sort of dark issue, because you can hide it. You can. We know this through years and years of research on battered and abused women or children. You can very much hide what's going on at home or what's going on inside of you and cover that up. And then what ends up happening is it sort of becomes overwhelming and to the point where you can no longer deal with it. So mental health is a big issue. But the precursors are not just mental health. It's receiving the benefits. It's having a sense of, even sometimes just having a sense of contributing and a sense of being part of something bigger than yourself. There are a number of issues. And, you know, getting into something else, another project, either whether it be work or whether it be school or identifying with another community of people, that can be a lot of the problems as well. But mental health is probably the biggest issue. Homeless veterans can also be defined differently. Homeless people and different administrations have defined it differently. Homelessness can be defined as somebody who actually lives on the street, or it can be defined as somebody who just doesn't own a home and they are staying with their sister or their friend, and they go from family place to friend place to another place to crash, and they jump around to places until they've worn out their welcome everywhere, and the last place they have to go is on the street or at a shelter. A lot of the homeless shelters in America for veterans don't allow women. And when we ask them, why don't you allow women, they say they're concerned for women's safety. And so our very next question to them is it safer on the streets for these women? And then an even smaller number of these shelters allow children. And because that's the fastest growing demographic of homeless veteran, that's an issue that we need to get front of immediately. What's being done about that? Not enough, because the suicide rates are growing. And suicide is obviously the end result of a culmination of a lot of severe issues. And at the point of suicide, there's really nothing anybody can do anymore except think about what they didn't do. But even that doesn't seem to be enough. You know, how many more military suicides do we need to have before we identify what the issue is? And the problem with addressing suicide, too, is that everybody's issue can be different. It could be different reasons and different triggers. What's being done about homelessness and some of these other more severe issues, the VA recognizes that there is an issue. There has been a significant amount of money, and in my notes somewhere I have the statistics of how many millions of dollars that the Veterans Administration has allocated for grant money to organizations that want to help homeless veterans. The problem is that money is not being applied for and it's not being used. And when it's not applied for and it's not used, it goes right back into the government's coffers. So we called last summer and spoke to them. And at the time, it was spring, just before the cutoff date. And there was several million dollars available specifically for women veterans issues. And nobody applied for that money. So what we're seeing is caregivers needing to, people who actually want to start homeless shelters, people who actually want to run them. It's a huge, enormous task, because it takes so many different components to come in play. And a lot of communities have done this, but they're not cross-leveling and training and going to other places and starting shelters in other places. So if you have anything inside of you that wants to, you know, any part of you that wants to get involved and to go into the nonprofit sector and to really seriously put your nose to the grindstone and you know, bring this issue really close to hand, definitely look into the grant programs that the VA puts out there, because they put the money out there and they're waiting for people to take it and use it. Any other questions? Nothing about Afghanistan or military jobs. Yes. Okay.
You said you had to prove that you were in combat. Did you feel also that when you were in combat that you had to prove yourself to your male counterparts that you could do it, that you were able, and to have like the respect?
All the time. Every single day. Every single day. You know, there are people I don't feel that way. I don't feel that way with anymore because they worked with me and they saw, they know me. But I think for every woman, that's something that we do talk about when we get together, is that feeling of feeling like you have to work twice as hard. Additionally, I was a reservist working with an active duty unit that had quite a history and a reputation of being pretty hardcore. The 10th Mountain Division is pretty famous. They are the most deployed division in the entire U.S. military. So, yeah, absolutely. But also, as a reservist, I felt like I had to work twice as hard to prove myself to the active duty component. But you do. You know, getting into the more personal side of it and my own personal experiences, I was also an NCO, a non-commissioned officer, so I led soldiers. I didn't have any soldiers of my own to lead, but I felt like all the women, all the female soldiers in my section were sort of under my care. I was 29, 30 at the time when I was deployed. Actually, I take that back, 20, 28-ish. And they were, like I said, 19, 20, very young, 18, 19, 20, very young soldiers. So you can't ever let them see you break down, ever. You always have to be a rock. You always have to be strong. You can't rely. You don't necessarily have someone to talk to and tell all of your issues to. Being a leader is a very, very stressful and overwhelming task at times, especially in the military. And I got to be honest with you, I don't know how I did it, and I certainly don't know how younger soldiers do it. I really, and service members, because my position as an E5 at the time would have typically been a 22, 23-year-old. And a lot of you coming out of college who go into the military are going in as first lieutenants. So you'll be leading soldiers as well. And I think it's really important for, if you don't know some, find some crusty NCOs and learn some stuff about being a leader of soldiers before you get out there and get in trouble. So, no, thank you for asking that, but it's very true. One of the best ways, if you go into the military, to overcome that issue is be able to do a lot of push-ups, run really fast, and do a lot of sit-ups. Typically, if you can do really well on the physical tests and you know your job, you're not going to get messed with too much. That's something that I sort of would tell the young soldiers coming in is don't slack off on the physical stuff. If you can pull your own and carry your weight, it's like you should be, because when you put that uniform on, you're really no different than the people standing next to you. Then you have to be able to do that. You have to be able to. You can't slack. You can't bat your eyelashes and get away with things. But you definitely need to be able to do the job and prove yourself. And you know, it's. I'd like to say that the military is not like that anymore, but you can't let them see you cry. There's no crying in baseball, so it's still like that, unfortunately. Any more questions?
Well, first of all, I wanted to thank you for your service and everything like that. And I did watch you in your Senate testimony.
Thank you.
I thought you did a very fine job, and you really did lay it out. And I specifically wanted to come here to talk to you personally. I want to introduce myself a little bit. I am Brigadier General Roma Amundson. I am the Assistant Adjutant General for Nebraska and for the Nebraska Army National Guard. I've been in for 32 years, and so I do want to say that, yes, you do have to do your physical fitness. I just came from running 2.5 miles. So.
Well, thank you for your service.
Yeah.
My goodness.
But in any case, what you have said, though, is really very – have you worked very much with Grace After Fire?
I have not worked directly with Grace After Fire, but we use them as a resource.
Okay.
Grace After Fire is an organization. I encourage you to go online and look them up. They're an organization that deal, and you could probably speak to this more, specifically with the issues that we talked about today. At AWV, we're focused on much broader. We don't want to reinvent the wheel because mm-hmm. we see that there are organizations out there that are addressing specifically needs of women who have suffered from military sexual trauma or PTSD, number of issues. In Grace After Fire, Swords to Plowshares, there's Service Women's Action Network. There are a number of organizations out there that work with women on those issues. And whenever we get contact from women who need those resources, we absolutely give them a list of resources and say, please contact these people. Give an Hour is a nonprofit organization that has lawyers and attorneys. The Give an Hour is a nonprofit organization that has therapists and mental health professionals that give an hour of their time to talk to veterans off record. And then there's also the National Veterans Legal Assistance Program or something where lawyers actually give their time pro bono to help veterans as well. But yes, Grace After Fire is a great organization.
Okay, I just was wondering because now I've just been duly come on to that. And I'm on the executive board for the National Executive Board. And so what I'm actually doing here in Nebraska is that I want to talk to the veterans, to the president, because I think that I want to initiate a study of women's veterans here in Nebraska, women veterans here in Nebraska, to find out what the care is like here in Nebraska. I've talked with Cindy Nemec Brown, and anyway, she is very much concerned about that also. She's the director of women's affairs here within Nebraska. And I have talked with the Department of Psychology here at Nebraska to see if we can get an intern to do a little bit of work on that. But I think, you know, that what you have spoken to is so critical because I have seen that with my own people. You know, when people come back, you know, the issues that they have, one of the most touching things that I had experienced was when women who are moms who come back from service, one of the things are that when they are actually in the home, they are really the caregivers. And it seems as though that when they come back home, oh my goodness, you know, the husband, and you know, this is just the typical way it is, the husband says, oh, well, now you can take care of the finances, you can take care of the kids, send them off to school, you can wash the clothes, do the dishes,
I don't want this
and
job anymore.
Like this,
yeah, they give it all back.
And manage your own full-time job that you left. Right. And, you know, they all of a sudden feel very, very vulnerable.
Overwhelmed and
vulnerable. Yeah, overwhelmed. Yeah. And I've come across that. And, you know, we've dealt with suicides, you know, in the military and everything like this. So it's very, very difficult. And what you've said is absolutely true. I also want to say just one thing also in regard to this. You were talking about women in combat, and that is a really difficult thing that people have to prove. And women nowadays, you know, we had a gun truck crew with a truck company, and there were, it was an all-female gun truck crew. Mm-hmm. That's just amazing, you know. That was the first one.
Right.
And anyway, then also we had a combat medic. We had a medic who was with on a convoy going up to help some wounded Marines. And you know how the IEDs are set up. They're set up in chains. Mm-hmm. And anyway, she was killed. And her driver was terrifically wounded. We had another woman, too, who was pulling security in a vehicle. And that vehicle struck an IED. And she and another passenger in the were killed. And so, I mean, you know, when these come home, you know, and it's kind of like, it puts a person down to say that you have to prove that you were in combat when you are in combat. So, you know, this is one of the things that I think that we need to have an awareness around the state, around the nation. And I definitely would like to talk to the president after a while.
No, I think that it's a very critical point that I forgot to mention. Another way that every one of you in this room can help is by asking someone that you know who's a veteran. Just ask them what it was like, or just talk to them about their experiences, not from a critical point. You know, don't get into the politics, don't get into the policies in Iraq or weapons of mass, none of that stuff. Just ask them, what was it like? You know, what was basic training like? Everybody likes to tell basic training stories. So, you know, you ask them something, get them talking. One of the things that I saw when I was with my special forces buddies in Afghanistan, we would get a bonfire together every night. We'd go around steal wood and get a bonfire together. And around this bonfire, these guys would just talk. There wasn't anything instigated. There wasn't anything set up. They would just talk. And I watched these guys and observed this healing happen just from talking about what happened that day and sort of just getting it off their chest and laughing about crazy things that you never would in a million years think you would laugh about. But somehow when you're in a combat zone, they suddenly become very funny to you. But they just get together, and that's sort of how the process started. And for a lot of people who, like special forces, they're like my heroes. You know, they're the macho guys who never show any chinks in their armor. I wondered how they dealt with what they saw on a daily basis. And that's when I discovered that's how they dealt with it, is they just kind of came back after a mission, had a bonfire, drank some Red Bull and Coke, and debriefed each other. You know, just sort of, not in that kind of debrief, but, you know, and just talked about what they went through. So one of the things that we started to try to do with AWV is just get groups of women together. Just get groups of women veterans together. You don't have to do anything but provide appetizers and maybe some wine, and it's amazing the things you'll hear. It's amazing sort of that connection and the bond and the camaraderie that they get back. And a lot of veterans miss that camaraderie. So one of the things I always tell people is, you know, if you work for Big Brothers Big Sisters, or you work for, you maybe volunteer with at a school, you know, ask about bringing in a woman veteran to talk about her experiences, just about being a soldier. My sister the other day was at drill in Arizona. We belong to the Arizona Reserve Unit. And she said she was walking on the grounds at her hotel, and this little boy, who was probably about 3 years old, stopped whatever it was he was doing with his parents and looked at her and said, "Soldier." And so my sister just wasn't sure if that's what he said or not, but he just stopped in his tracks. And she kind of looked at him, and she didn't want to be rude, so she sort of walked slowly away because she wasn't sure if they were talking to her or not. And the woman, he was with his grandmother of the little boy, said, excuse me, miss, you know, and she just turned around, and this little boy came up to her, and he acted really shy, and, you know, the woman said, his great-grandfather was in World War II, and he loves soldiers. We always tell him that soldiers are our heroes, and my sister, completely dumbfounded, didn't know what to say, and just asked the little boy if she could give him a hug, and she said that, you know, it was the greatest appreciation she received in 6 years of service. That one moment meant more to her. It was better than anything anybody had said or done for her in 6 years of military service in terms of expressing their appreciation. You know, it was a hug from a little three-year-old boy. Another time I was at a grocery store on Memorial Day. I had just gotten off duty and I was shopping. And I was in the grocery store. I was walking towards some section and this old man comes up to me and he says to me, "Thank you for your service." And he shakes my hand. And I was completely taken aback, and I just looked at him and said, "Well, thank you." And his wife comes up, and she goes, "Don't let him fool you. He's in the Air Force for 30 years. He was, you know, he had served in, I think it was Vietnam." And she was so cute because she was telling me his background, and he was just being real sheepish, and he kept going, "I'm not here to talk about me. I'm here to thank this young lady for her service." And I didn't know what to say. But I just said, "Thank you," you know, and I kind of walked away. And then I thought about it, and I felt so guilty, and I'm like, this man just thanked me for my service, and I've only been in for 4 years. So I stood at the entrance of the grocery store and waited 20 minutes till he left so I could thank him for his service, because I had realized that I hadn't done that. But you don't know how much it means. You don't. I mean, we have Honor Flights. It's another nonprofit organization in Washington, D.C. that flies World War II veterans and pretty soon Korean veterans and veterans of Korea and Vietnam to Washington, D.C. to see the memorials before they pass. And they'll put out a call or an email, and we'll show up to the airport, and we'll stand as they get off. They usually are in wheelchairs. They're very old gentlemen now. They come off the plane, and now the women are also, they're bringing women as well, and we just stand there and clap, and they just cry. You just don't know how much it means to thank a service member, how much it means to them. So please do that as well. That's another way you can help. Any more questions? Nope. Yes, go ahead.
First of all, thanks for your service and being here and for the work that you do, which is really important. I've been doing a lot of research lately on women in the military, and it always seems to boil down to that, should women be allowed in combat or not? And you're saying, of course, that it's not black and white, obviously. But then people will still come up with all those same arguments about why women should not be allowed in combat. So I'm just kind of wondering how you would negotiate that as you seek to have this wording changed in a way that is more more inclusive and recognizes the reality of women serving in combat.
Yes.
While addressing the people who said women
should
not
be. These are the questions I was waiting for.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. The issue of women serving in the military, there are several layers to this. There's women serving in the military, there's women serving in combat, and then there's women serving in combat military occupational specialties. Now, everybody gets really mad when we start saying, put women in the infantry. So we haven't said that, and we're not saying that, okay? What we're saying, there's my personal view, and then there's the official view of American Women Veterans. The official view of American Women Veterans is that we want the policy change to reflect the reality of what's happening in our current conflicts, and what is going to be the reality for ages to come. This force on force, you know, these guys on this side, this guy, these guys on this side, that's not the reality of our world anymore. Counterinsurgency operations, which women have proven time and time and time again to be very valuable in assisting with and in conducting operations, is now the norm. In terms of overcoming women in combat, like I said, they already are. A lot of times we get arguments from people who say things like, oh, well, a man's very protective and he's going to protect a woman. I did not see it that way. I knew men who were trained special forces people who in the heat of battle froze and couldn't do their jobs. Not many. I shouldn't say that like it's a plural. I know of one. One particular instance. I know of other people who in the heat of battle, I know of, actually of several more women who in the heat of combat laid down suppressive fire, maneuvered, evaded the actual combat itself, the contact. I know of one female soldier who cleaned parts of her friend off of her and drove on with mission. So I also know in my own experience that when it happened, when our attack happened, the guys weren't wondering what I was doing. They weren't worried about me. They weren't protecting me. They weren't looking out for me. We all fell into mission mode and did exactly what we had been trained to do. And this is where we talk to our soldiers about training kicks in, and training is so important. It sounds like you're doing tedious things and it's the same thing over and over again and you already know this, but you know what? You do it because when a different part of your brain gets triggered and the adrenaline kicks in, you go into automatic pilot and you do exactly what you're supposed to do. And that's exactly what happened. So there are a number of experiences out there and a number of times where this issue, this debate has been on both sides kind of debunked, both by people in the military and also supported. There are also those instances very much so where women have felt like they were sort of marginalized or protected. So that does become an issue. Personally, the way I feel on the issue is as a leader, as a coach, as a leader, as somebody who is responsible for getting a mission done or a task done, if I have 20 positions and I have 50 candidates, I want the 20 best. I don't care who you are, what religion, what side of the aisle in politics you are, what gender you are, what your race, your nationality, none of that. I don't care. I just want the 20 best. And I think that's what is going to make our military even stronger. And what has over the years is that in services and in jobs and occupations where we allow women to compete with the men and to perform, a lot of them you will see women perform just as well, if not sometimes better. I won't put this down as fact, but I have been told many times that women are naturally better marksmen than men. We actually shoot better than they do, and yet I can't be a sniper from the military. That doesn't really make a lot of sense, but that is the way it is. There are a lot of other issues. There are a lot of other reasons that they'll put up there, like sanitary reasons and so on and so forth. Recently, I was just asked, because I am preparing possibly and going back over, I was just asked about, you know, sanitary issues and stuff like that, and I said, you know what? How about you let me worry about that? Women have been dealing with this for ages and ages and ages. You do what you do, I'll do what I do, and we'll get the job done. So there are a number of arguments, and I'd be happy to talk to you after this and give you anything that you may need in your research or your study, from anecdotal evidence to also what we see out there. And I know a number of, we have a lot of men on our board who are have infantry or combat arms background who would be more than happy to talk to you as well about contributions of women and how and what they're doing and who these men want to serve with. They want to serve with the best. And if that best person happens to be a woman, that's who they're taking with them. So any other questions? Yes.
Hi, Hi, thank you for being here tonight and informing all of us about these things. I'm a master's student getting my degree in counseling, and my desire is to work with returning soldiers, male and female, and their families. And I was wondering if there are any prevalent coping strategies for women coming out of the combat zone that are different from men. A lot of what I read is about male post-traumatic stress disorder, and I was wondering if there's anything that differs between men and women.
That's a really tough one. I could probably tell you what I know from my experience and my friend's experience, but that's really something that we definitely want to put out there and ask our members to sort of get back to us on. Personally, for me, it was writing, talking about it. I actually have thought about at length the differences between my coping with it and my partner, my buddy. He bottled everything up. He never talked about it. He doesn't celebrate his alive day. Alive day is what we call the day that we almost died. It's sort of like a rebirth. It's like a birthday. They started to have us call it that because we used to call it the day we got blown up, or I call it the Big Bang. but, you know, that's sort of when him and I became brother and sister for real, you know, sort of born again. But he dealt with it very differently. He internalized it immediately. And I think that's really why the stresses and the internal pressure sort of manifested itself physically, because he started having a lot of issues before I did, from fainting for no reason to dizzy spells to his equilibrium being off. Also the concussion of the blast, at that proximity and that number of that strength. But he really did, and I was talking about it from the get-go. I mean, from that night, I was telling people what I remembered because I had blacked out for a little bit, so there are things I don't remember. So I was getting stories from other people. What did you see? What did you hear? You know, what happened? And that really helped me piece it together, but I think more than anything, it removed me from being the victim inside of it to I was sorting out outside of it and studying it. You know, and it gave me an outlet to talk to people and just kind of say, look, you know, this is what happened. But it really took somebody telling me what to expect. I remember I couldn't sleep. I had an adrenaline rush like you wouldn't believe. I mean, you don't feel any pain. And for hours and hours and hours, it was ridiculous. And for days, I didn't sleep. I was up all night. And I was sitting out on our little, what we call provincial reconstruction team, a very small little post. And in the middle of the night, this guy comes up to me. He sits down about where you're sitting, about, I don't know, 15 feet away. And he pulls up a chair. He doesn't get close. And he says to me, he was British, in this British accent, that, you know, and he starts to tell me about when it happened to him. And then he said, I lost my mind. I thought I was going crazy. I forgot things. I would be walking somewhere, and then I would completely forget where I was going and why. He goes, I started to absolutely feel like I was going crazy. He told me that I would have memory issues probably, that a number of things would happen, that I wouldn't want to necessarily talk to my family. He was there. It was like a dream. It was so surreal. It may have been a dream because I think I ever saw him again. But he got up and he said, you know what? I wish somebody had told me what to expect because then I wouldn't have felt like I was going crazy. And he goes, so I hope it helps you for what it's worth. And he walked away and I never saw him again. And so I didn't think any of that stuff was going to happen to me because I was fine and my buddy was the one having all the issues, but it did eventually absolutely happen. But definitely peer-to-peer. Peer-to-peer has got to be where it starts because I, as a combat vet, am a lot more likely to talk to somebody who might know what it's like to be there, to open up initially, than to somebody who hasn't. And I think probably one of the biggest things I could really kind of hone down and drill into mental health care professionals is talk a lot to veterans outside of your office. Get involved in the community with other veterans. See them in their off time. You know, see them, get to know them as people. And then when you get in the office and you're talking one-on-one to a vet, you can kind of see sort of what they're dealing with and see both sides of it, but you can speak their language. So I hope that helps. Anyone else? Yes.
Well, I'll begin by thanking you for coming and for verbalizing, because we have a lot of vets in my family, and not everybody can come and talk. So thank you for that. You briefly mentioned media earlier, and I kind of want to go back to that. Hollywood tends to not necessarily portray things accurately, as we know, and they tend to portray things very polarized. You have G.I. Jane or you have Private Benjamin. And I was wondering what your thoughts and your feelings were on that and if any problems are created from that.
Oh, where to start with that one? Has anybody seen, what's the one that just came out? Green Zone? Okay. What about, what's the one with the EOD guy? Hurt Locker. Anyone seen Hurt Locker? Okay. You know military, right? The two, I think you both. Okay. So the Hurt Locker, if you see the movie, I have not seen it because I have been told by many people not to watch it because I would probably get very upset. But it's about an EOD person. An EOD in the military is explosives ordnance detection or disposal. I just want you to know while you're watching that movie that women can be EOD techs as well. And a very good friend of mine from basic training who was the most amazing woman in the military. I mean, this girl had blisters on the, I told you we like to save basic training stories. She had blisters on the bottom of her feet, like the whole pad of the bottom of her foot. And underneath those blisters, she had blood blisters from the ruck marches and stuff we did in basic training. And she never once complained. She was hardcore. And she was an EOD. And she ended up being raped by her supervisor and is now out of the military. And the military lost an incredible asset, an incredibly intelligent and vital and beautiful woman because of the way they dealt and handled that issue. But Hurt Locker is one of them. I've been warned by other vets not to watch. Private Benjamin. The great thing I can say about Private Benjamin is I think most people know that's not really how it is in the military. The other one, G.I. Jane, is also unrealistic because, well, first, it's G.I. Jane, and she's going to Navy SEAL school. But no, we don't get a lot of people saying, is this what it's like? What we do try to do is, or do try to sort of put the message out there for, is to watch the documentaries. Lioness, though, even, for example, Lioness will sell itself as saying that it's the first time women have acted in combat in that capacity. But it's actually really not. There are a number of women, and I named some of the military jobs that they do, that act in that capacity all the time and have been since the beginning of the war in both conflicts. But it is a really great movie, a documentary that does sort of tell the story of this specific team of lionesses who did not enlist in a job or any job that they thought they would be outside the wire doing, especially like administrative assistant or chef. Or wheel track mechanic. You know, these women, then they found themselves in the heat of battle in Iraq and working with other units like Marines and so on and so forth. They hadn't been trained in Marine tactics. They hadn't been trained in door kicking and combat tactics because the military does not train all of the soldiers at the same level of combat training. They don't train all of the soldiers like they do infantry soldiers. So there's that issue as well. But that movie does definitely address those issues very well. There's another documentary that we would be happy to provide a copy to the school to screen. It's called, it's a program, a series done by In Their Boots, and the documentary is called Outside the Wire, and it profiles one of the women that I spoke about tonight who was the one that was raped while she was pulling security. They nicknamed her Combat Barbie because she's beautiful, and she did her job and pulled her own weight, and then unfortunately later on she ended up being raped and then getting out of the military, but they do profile her in that film as well. So there is a number of documentaries, but nothing major. We have recently really pushed for and sort of harassed Hollywood to do a documentary a movie on the WASPs, which was the women who first first flew. They flew World War II, and what they did is they would ship all the men off to World War II to fly combat airplanes, but they needed more people, and they didn't have enough pilots. So they started bringing women in to fly these planes. Now, these women were not considered military, so they didn't receive any military benefits. They were considered civilians, and if they died, their sisters had to come together, the women had to come together, take a pool of money, and send the body home for funeral services and pay for funeral services because the military wouldn't pay for funeral services. They weren't able to be buried in Arlington Cemetery, and there are a number of other issues, but we've been really, really pushing for someone, and anybody in here write screenplays. Write that screenplay. okay, the WASPs of World War II. They're amazing women. There are a handful of them, and there are very few of them alive today. So if you're going to do that movie, you better get in touch with a few. So, but they are just recently got recognized by the White House. So the way the media portrays women is they're just frankly not really, they're not doing it. Doonesbury, we were talking about earlier, Gary Trudeau at Doonesbury started putting women in his comic strip. But, you know, he appeals to a certain demographic, and it's a small thing. But the documentaries are probably the best way right now that we're getting it out there. Other movies like Jarhead and, yeah, they're Hollywood. They're very much Hollywood. There was a huge uproar about Hurt Locker, though, because so many people sold it as being true testimony about what actually happens, and really it just was Hollywood again. So, many more questions?
One final question, unless anyone else here has any questions. I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about, you'd mentioned that you interacted with a lot of Afghans in the field, and I was wondering what was their reaction to seeing, you know, female soldiers in uniform.
The reactions. This is something that, especially in Afghanistan, I really try to drive home to my leadership. They think that because it's a Muslim country and because they, women wear burqas and women are treated are very segregated from public society, that they would have a problem with me working amongst them. I stopped in women's prison. I was in a women's prison and spoke to women in a prison in Helmand province, and that was an experience in itself. But I was the only one that could go in. My interpreter, who was male, had to sit at the door because although I had been trained in Pashto, everywhere you go is a different dialect and you can't understand anything they're saying. The women there had their children. They were raising their children at prison, and a lot of them didn't even know why they were there. And some of them were there for having been accused of killing their husbands. Then also, I was able to go to a women's center. So I was able to go in and talk to these women. And the women are sick of war. They are tired of it. So they are, after they get done asking you why you don't have any kids and how your husband let you get, you know, come to Afghanistan, they are very curious and then also very forthcoming. And very genuine about talking about the issues in their day-to-day life and all of the things that they confront and address and what life for them is like. In terms of dealing with the men, I only ever had problems in areas that were known Taliban strongholds and areas that were known to be populated or influenced by Taliban heavily. And sort of it was an indicator, you know, but most of the time, men loved talking to me because they didn't get to talk to a woman usually that wasn't their family member, but they were so curious and so amazed. But it had its sort of its pluses and minuses. At one point, we were out on a mission and we were walking through a bazaar, and a woman came up in a burqa and tried to give me her daughter because she knew that only a woman would understand. And I think she also knew that her daughter would have a better life. I don't know if that's exactly what happened, but there are some things that are communicated that you really just only know. And she was told to go away. So that was really rough. But dealing with the men and dealing with the people in that society was an amazing experience, and again, I can't wait to go back. And in fact, on the way to the airport this morning, my cab driver was from Afghanistan, one of the what I call the older generation, one of the elders, and he talked about the communist invasion. He talked about Kabul in the 70s when women went to university and wore business suits and skirts. He didn't talk so much about all of that as much as I had already known a lot of that stuff from my previous teachers, but he remembers that time in the history of Afghanistan. So they're in the rural areas, they're a bit more apprehensive because they're just not sure what to do with me. But after they know that it's okay to talk to me and that I'm there to help them, they're very, very interested. And I had several marriage proposals, many, many. I had lots of gifts too, but you have to give those back, so.